Wouldn't it be strange if everyone you knew was about the same age as you are? Now, life might be a little easier in one way. Might have a lot in common. And it might be easier to hang out together and plan some things to do. But frankly, it'd be pretty boring, wouldn't it? And thankfully, that's not the way life works. And it's certainly not the way things are in the church. The way society grows, it's inevitable that we'll have a combination of people of different ages. And of course, that's true in our immediate families as well. A couple of months ago, my wife, Randy, and I spent a weekend out in the Denver area with her family. And they rented a big vacation home. And most of her immediate family was able to be together, her sister and her husband, their three adult sons. And the reason we were getting together was because their oldest son was getting married. And so we met his fiancée, and magically, while we were there, she became his wife. And then we met her family as well. Randy's brother and his wife and his son, his brother's son, his brother's daughter and her family were all there. Our daughter and our son were there with their families. It was about 25 people altogether, which is a fairly big family gathering in our experience. But frankly, it's a pretty small sampling of my wife's extended family. As we were enjoying the weekend together, I found on a few occasions I would just kind of sit back and just take in the scene. Because it was so enjoyable to see everyone having a good time together, spending time together as a family. You could see all the family resemblances, and I met some nieces and nephews I hadn't met before, and I saw other family members I hadn't seen for such a long time. And it just was a kind of a heartwarming situation just to see everyone together enjoying each other's company. Now, we spanned on that occasion just three generations. So it wasn't really a big spread of age necessarily. The youngest was one of my nieces, who was about 6 years of age. And the oldest person there was me. And that made me feel a little older, but it's interesting, again, to see the family developing. My part in all of this started about 50 years ago when I first met Rani and her family, and now it's grown to this. And it's going to continue growing because with her son married, Rani's sister Terry is now anticipating becoming a grandmother. That's the way families grow. From generation to generation. So let's consider God's family. Our church family started on the day of Pentecost in the year 31, and it has been developing now for a period of over 1,900 years. And your extended church family includes at least five generations. And you have family members literally scattered all over the world. Think about how God feels when his family gathers together. When we come together for a local Sabbath service, or when we combine with other congregations on a special occasion, and certainly when we gather for the Feast of Tabernacles. We've always considered the Feast of Tabernacles to be kind of a church family gathering, family renewal, and we've had many occasions to have those meetings, those Feast of Tabernacles together. Many of you have been to some far-flung places, and now you know your brothers, your sisters who live in completely different cultures, different parts of the world. Over the years, my wife and I have been to Barbados, Sri Lanka, South Africa, Jamaica, Mississippi. You've been to a lot of places too, and you have family all around the world. And just like personal families, the church family is a mix of several generations. Now, in American culture, generations sometimes don't mix very well. There are differences between people of different age groups who grew up at different times, and in society in general, that can cause separation and even tension. In fact, one of Satan's most effective strategies is to create conflict between generations. While that's true in society in general, it is not what God intends for his family. The title of the sermon this afternoon is Throughout Your Generations. God intends for his family to be connected and unified. The family connection that we share in our church family crosses generational lines. And that unity of the family is one of the most encouraging and most valuable blessings that we share. This afternoon, I want to focus on three factors that draw us together as a trans-congregational family. But first, let's consider a few demographics. What are the generations that are represented in the church? Well, first of all, we have to define what a generation is. It's kind of a loosely defined word in some ways. Generally, it's defined as the average period of time that it takes for a child to be born, grow up, and begin to have children of his own. That's a generation. Those who are born in a particular time frame are regarded collectively as a generation. So we have, at this point, five living generations, all of which are represented in the church. Now, since generations are somewhat loosely defined, if you do any study about generations, you'll see that there are some differences in different sources in terms of defining a generation or the years that would include a particular generation. So I'm going to use a summary that's published by the Barna Group. That's an organization that does research about trends in the Christian religion. So here's how Barna Group breaks down the generations. Now, don't expect you to remember any of this, but as I go through this, you can at least see where you are in terms of this progression of generations. The oldest generation is called the elders or traditionalists. And those in this age group were born before 1946, which would make them currently about 72 years of age or older. Those are the elders or the traditionalists. The next category or group is called the boomers. Boomers were born between 1946 and 1964. 1946 to 1964, which would make a person who is a boomer between the ages of 54 and 71. Then comes Generation X, or Gen X. Gen X includes my children, my wife and I's children, born between 1965 and 1983. 1965 to 1983, which would put them 35 to 53 years of age. Then come the millennials. Millennials were born between 1984 and 1998 and are between the ages of 20 and 34. Those are considered called the millennials. And then the most recent generation, and they've been dubbed Generation Z, or Gen Z. Now, I kind of wonder how they chose X and Z as names or categories, labels for millennials, because it looks like we're out of room. So I don't know what follows Z. But anyway, the current generation, Gen Z, born between 1999 and 2015, between the ages of 3 and 19. So that would include, of course, our teen speech club. And many of those who are what we categorize as young adults would fit in the millennial or the Gen X range. And many of those who have more of the leadership responsibilities in the church today would be in the boomers category. So we have this mix of members of the church, different places in the church, different responsibilities in the church. But we're all God's family, his church family. Now, there's always a lot of discussion about the differences between the generations. There are some obvious reasons for differences. And it's inevitable that there would be differences in this society, in the way that the society is organized today, between generations. Think about how different the world was in 1930 compared to today. Or how different the world was before 1960, or in 1960, compared to today. For that matter, think about how different the world became on September 11th, 2001. Things change, and as things in our society change, it affects those who are growing up in it. Think about the impact of technology. Technology has a huge impact on the generations as they come along with what technology they grow up with. Think about how social and lifestyle trends change from one generation to the next. How entertainment changes as new modes of entertainment are developed. World events, as we mentioned, also will change the environment in which people are growing up. Economic factors change things as well. There are many ways or reasons why one generation is different from the previous, even though we're all living in the same world, and even though maybe they're your children born at different times, growing up in the same family, and yet there can be generational differences. Each generation likes to make fun of the previous generation. They make fun of you for your clothing that you had. You know, ever shown your high school kids, your teenagers, your high school picture, your graduation picture? Get ready to be humiliated if you have not done that before. They're going to make fun of the clothes you're wearing, the how big the tie is, your hair, the polyester jacket you're wearing. They're going to have a good time with it. But guess what? Their kids are going to make fun of them too. We make fun of the way that, or the cars that people drove, the various things that have changed over the years. You know, when I was your age, we had 3 TV channels, and we had to walk across the room to turn a dial to change. Or when I was your age, I worked 10 hours a day in a factory for 50 cents an hour, and I was glad to have a job. Someday the teens in the room today will tell their grandchildren, when I was your age, we had to drive our own cars. No matter how hard we try, as parents, our children grow up in a different world than we did. And on top of that, and maybe part of it, Satan is working busily to introduce superficial differences to separate families and generations. One of the ways that he causes confusion, and he loves confusion, he's the master of confusion. And if he can scramble up relationships between generations, then he's won a huge victory. But that is certainly not what God intends. So what I want to do this afternoon is review with you 3 factors that draw God's church family together across generational lines. 3 factors that unite us in a way that is different from society around us, and in a way that will thwart Satan's attempt to cause separation and confusion. The first factor we'll review is the truth of God never changes. The truth of God never changes. Across all generations, there is a general tendency to believe that right and wrong are relative, that they change based on circumstances. All the generations of man or people have that general approach. It is true that the younger generations have an even greater level of acceptance of that philosophy, that right and wrong change depending on the circumstances. But we understand, and what draws us together as a family is that the truth that God reveals never changes. Let's look at a couple of passages. Let's begin in Exodus chapter 10. Exodus chapter 10, verse 2. In the previous verse, God tells Moses to go to Pharaoh. So this is in the time just before, or as God is beginning to work in Egypt and with Israel to have Israel to be rescued from Egypt. The Lord said to Moses, "Go into Pharaoh, for I've hardened his heart and the hearts of his servants, that I may show these signs of mine before him." Verse 2, "And that you may tell in the hearing of your son and your son's son the mighty things which I have done in Egypt." The history of God's hand in working with his people is part of our legacy as God's people. What happened in Egypt so long ago was to be told and retold from one generation to the next to establish God's power and God's concern for his people and how God acted on their behalf. It is what is to be handed down from one generation to the next. Chapter 12, verse 14. This is in the general instruction given about the Passover and the days of unleavened bread. Israel is about to observe the first Passover, the one that led to their being dismissed from Egypt. Notice chapter 12, verse 14. "This day," speaking of the Passover leading into the days of unleavened bread, "shall be to you a memorial, and you shall keep it as a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. You shall keep it as a feast by an everlasting ordinance." When God revealed his plan and acted on behalf of his people, he established by those events this particular festival which we continue to observe, and which as we observe it, we rehearse each year what happened, how God, again, rescued his people. It is to be kept throughout our generations. It is handed down from one generation to the next as part of the blessing that God has given to us as his church family. The instruction of God is itself a memorial. It reminds us who God is. It reminds us of the law that came from him and that we are never to stray from that law. Turn back to Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews chapter 13. Read verse 8. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 8. A very simple but important statement. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. What was true and what was taught and what was revealed is the same as it carries through the generations. As I've mentioned, one of Satan's most effective strategies is to create discontinuity, to introduce changes, instability, and confusion. Jesus Christ made promises in a covenant form to Abraham. They were fulfilled in a physical way with the nation of Israel, and they will be fulfilled thoroughly and completely through God's church. They do not change. The promises that Jesus Christ made, the instructions that have been given, are the same yesterday, today, and forever. We live in what some are now calling a post-truth environment. The phrase post-truth refers to opinions and decisions that are based on emotion or personal belief rather than facts. You make up your own reality, basically, is what it means. People decide what they believe, what their values are, based on how they feel, rather than on factual information. Now, as I mentioned before, people have always tended to view themselves as the primary source of moral authority, meaning that each individual can decide for himself or herself what's right and what's wrong, or that what is right or wrong may change based upon the immediate circumstances. Interesting, isn't it, that after all this time, we find ourselves exactly where everything started in the Garden of Eden. That's the exact message that Satan delivered to Adam and to Eve. You can be like God and decide for yourself what's right and what's wrong. But we understand, we recognize that truth is not relative. Right and wrong are not relative. They are based on absolutes that are from God's law. Turn to John chapter 8, verse 32. John chapter 8, verse 32. Jesus was having a discussion, an argument, I guess, with the Jews, as happened so many times. But he comes to the conclusion of this particular encounter. Verse 31, he tells those who were with him, who believed him, if you abide in my word, then you'll be my disciples. If you adhere to what I'm teaching, he said, you will be my disciples, the students who follow me. And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. God's law, God's revealed word, is universal and eternal. It applies in every generation as the standard of life. We, all of us, the generations in God's church, are connected and bonded by our calling, by our understanding of the truth that Jesus Christ speaks of. Now, I recognize that there are some fundamentalist Christians who have moral values based on their understanding of Scripture, and I do respect that. There are examples, you probably know of some, maybe in your neighborhood, maybe in your family, who part of a different Christian belief, but they do understand or base their lives on God's law as much as they can understand. But of course, these are the same people who believe that you can go to heaven when you die, you don't need to keep the Sabbath, and Christmas should be celebrated as Jesus' birthday. So there may be some elements of understanding or application of God's law that some may believe in, but we recognize that they don't really fully have truth. God has revealed truth, and the truth that we can receive then changes everything. It changes everything in our lives. And it changes it in the same way throughout all of God's family. In Matthew 16, verse 18, Jesus promised that his church would continue through every generation. He said the gates of the grave will not prevail against his church. That means that it passes along from one generation to the next. It's the same church based on the same beliefs, the same truth that God reveals, and the truth that never changes. Jesus promised that the church would continue, but it continues because God is determined, and Jesus is determined for it to, but it also gives us some responsibility. We have responsibility as well to maintain the understanding, the truth, the revelation that God has provided. And so it is part our responsibility as well to continue that tradition, so to speak, or that understanding of God's law. Consider what Paul wrote to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2. And we're going to talk a little bit more about Timothy in a minute. But Timothy was a minister, and Paul was his mentor. And Paul was giving Timothy instruction about being a faithful minister or evangelist, serving God's people. He says in verse 1, "You therefore, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus. And the things that you've heard from me among many witnesses, commit these to faithful men who will be able to teach others also." So the truth, the revelation, the understanding that God provides to his church is continued from one generation to the next through what is taught in the church. And Timothy is urged to choose men who will be able to continue to teach that truth that God has revealed. And so it passes down from one generation to the next. It doesn't change, even though the world around us continues to change. And we have a responsibility to continue to teach what we have been taught and to carry on that tradition of the truth of God from one generation to the next. You know, Dr. Levy has begun a series of classes on Foundation Institute Online. In this particular class, I really would strongly suggest that our younger members take time to listen to. This series of classes is on the book of Deuteronomy. Now, the name of the book may not be exciting. What is a Deuteronomy? Actually, Dr. Levy explains that. But the theme of the book of Deuteronomy is the next generation. That's the theme. I don't think he puts it exactly that way, but I think if you listen to his classes, you'll see that that is what this book is about. Specifically, the book of Deuteronomy was written to the generation of Israel whose parents had died in the wilderness, and they were coming into the promised land. And as they were doing so, they were reminded that they were God's nation, reminded of where they'd come from, reminded of how God expected them to live. Now, this generation that was entering the promised land did not have the same life experience as their parents. But they had the same God and the same laws and the same promises and the same warnings. I see many principles in the book of Deuteronomy that apply to every next generation. Every next generation can be reminded, as this book emphasizes, of what has come before and what it means to them as they continue in that same calling and in that same way. So one primary factor that bonds us together across generational lines is the truth that God has revealed to us, the truth of God, which never changes. Let's consider another factor. Another factor that bonds the generations together is that each generation must choose to stay connected to God. That's something that each generation must do for themselves. They must choose to stay connected through to God. And we also will note as we consider this point that through the circumstances and challenged circumstances of our lives, God will test each generation to prove whether they will obey, whether they'll stay connected to Him. Let's look at an example. Let's go back where we were in the sermonette, back to the book of Joshua. Joshua, we saw, was a strong and courageous man who led God's people when they moved from the wilderness into the land that God had promised to them. Let's look at something that happened during Joshua's time that emphasizes the importance of staying connected to God from one generation to the next. Joshua 24, verse 29. Joshua 24, verse 29, at the end of his life, it says, "It came to pass after these things that Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of God, died, being 110 years old. And they buried him," verse 30. Verse 31, interesting transition here. "Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had known all the works of the Lord which he had done for Israel." So for a period of time after Joshua died, the people of Israel continued to follow God and to stay committed to their covenant with him. Now we're going to pause and do a little bit of arithmetic here. Back in Numbers 14, verse 29, Numbers 14, verse 29, we're told that those Israelites who were 20 years old and older would die in the wilderness. These were the ones who, when they came to the land, refused to go in because they didn't trust God to take care of them. So they were to wander in the wilderness. All those 20 years and older would die in the wilderness. Now, when you look at the story carefully, you see from this point on, they were going to wander in the wilderness for another 38 years after this time they'd come to that border. So, those who entered the promised land after this period of wandering were 50 years of age at the oldest, 57 years of age at the oldest. Okay, so they were 19, they wandered for 38 years. They're 57 years of age when they come into the land of promise. Now, based on our understanding of the chronology of Joshua, this book covers a period of 25 years. So, when Joshua died, the oldest of those who had come into the land of promise would have been 82 years of age. That means during that 25 years, another generation of Israelites was born. This was took place during the time when Israel was settling the land of Canaan. So it says here in verse 31 that the elders, it speaks of the elders who outlived Joshua. Elders can have two meanings. It can mean simply older people, but it also implies leadership. And in Israel, the leaders were among the older generation, so probably means both in this sense. So these elders who outlived Joshua, had witnessed what God had done for Israel while they were settling in Canaan. Now, it doesn't say how long they outlived Joshua. It just says that they outlived Joshua for a period of time. Again, according to the class that's taught at Foundation Institute, the people continued to serve God for 21 more years until 1357 BC. We're getting to the point here. We're seeing generations come about. In 25 years that it took to settle the land of Canaan, a generation of Israelites were born who didn't have any recollection of the wilderness and certainly nothing of Egypt. Now we come for the next 21 or so years after Joshua died, the people are settled in the land of Canaan, and another generation is born. So drop down to chapter 2, verse 7 in Judges. Judges chapter 2, verse 7. It says, again, the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen the great works that God had done for Israel. So we've seen, just from this sketchy history, that two more generations of Israelites are born during this period of time. Verse 10 says, when all that generation had gathered to their fathers, that is, those who had been faithful to God after Joshua died, when all of those were gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord nor the work which he had done for Israel. So by the time we get to this now third generation, it says that they did not know the work that God had done and how he had served or cared for the people of Israel. So we see that there was a disconnect between this generation and their grandparents, those in the previous generation, two generations before them. There was a disconnect. This generation didn't know, didn't understand, didn't recognize what had happened before them, what their grandparents had experienced. Now, this disconnect was not because the grandparents didn't understand smartphones or didn't know how to use Instagram. It says that there was a disconnect because they did not know the Lord. They did not know God. A couple of points we can draw from that. We can ask, of course, what caused this? What led to this disconnect? First of all, we see in this situation the importance of teaching the next generation, the importance of continuing that connection from one generation to the next. If we don't do that, then the next generation is not going to have the understanding that they could. And secondly, we see how easy it is to lose our connection with God. Within two generations, maybe 40 to 50 years, there was a whole society that did not know God. And again, it reminds us of how important it is for each generation to stay connected and to teach that connection to their children. There are several scriptures that relate to the importance of a parent teaching their young children. I'll just mention them. I think you're familiar with them all. Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 through 9, talks about how the parents are to model God's way for their children. And everything that they do, or everything in their life, is to show how a Christian parent lives and how a Christian lives. In Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4, Fathers in particular are warned to bring up their children in the nurture of God, to teach them about God and his way. Proverbs 1 verse 8 speaks of fathers and mothers both teaching their children and the young people being willing to receive that instruction. It is the parents' responsibility primarily to teach their children, to make sure that they have at least the opportunity to make that connection and to maintain the connection. Of course, the church also makes an effort to work with parents in support of the younger generations in the church. Many different opportunities. The Encourage, Equip, and Inspire program provides general instruction for parents to follow to teach their younger children. We have the teen camps that focus on teaching practical and relevant application of God's way. Foundation Institute and special seminars for young adults help to establish them further and deeper in their connection to God as well. There are many opportunities and many responsibilities we have to maintain that connection. As we continue on here in Judges chapter 2, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they served the Baals. They served the pagan gods. And they forsook the Lord God of their fathers who had brought them out of Egypt. And they followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all around them. They bowed down to them and they provoked the Lord to anger. They forsook the Lord to serve other gods. The people of Israel became absorbed into the practices of the people around them. That's an important thing to note, because it's the parallel to us is clear. We live in an evil world, just as Israel did in their time. We need to guard against being drawn into it. Israel allowed themselves to drift into the society that was all around them. Now, of course, you're not going to literally bow down to an idol, but we can be seduced by the lifestyles of the world we live in. We can be vulnerable to the way of thinking of the world that we live in. And unless we stay connected to God, we may make the very same mistake Israel did, just in a different environment. Staying connected to God is an essential aspect of maintaining our generational, or maintaining the way and the truth of God throughout our generations. I need to move on because there's one more aspect I want to cover. I said earlier I would talk about Timothy a little later, so I lied. I'm not going to talk about Timothy because I ran out of time. We can come back and talk about him another time, I think, because he's an interesting example of a third-generation Christian who responded to the instruction that he was given and became a leader in his time of God's people, and he showed us a very positive example. So let's move on quickly then to a third factor. We've seen a couple of things, and, you know, I guess it's kind of a serious topic we're talking about today, but I hope we see it as something that's encouraging, because we have the opportunity to beat the world, to do things differently than what's happening all around us. We can draw together across all these arbitrary lines of age to continue in and to appreciate what God has given to us and what has been handed down to us by those who came before all of us. Let's move on to a third factor that we can consider that draws us together across these generational lines, and that is our responsibility to serve and care for one another. Our responsibility to serve and care for one another. Now, the world has its culture and its ways and its trends and things that people fall into. This is a primary aspect of the culture of God's church, that we recognize the opportunity and the responsibility to serve and to care for one another. Turn back to Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians, the second chapter. Verses 19 through 21. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 19. Paul writes, "Now therefore you're no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God." God has put together from different cultures and different generations a collection of people who are no longer separated or strangers to one another, but now together we form the household of God. Now, I know specifically Paul is writing to the Gentiles and their connection now to the church, but we're looking at it in the principle as well. That God has called together people who otherwise, most of us, except for our family members, wouldn't even know each other. Never would have crossed paths. But now we're a family. And God has brought us all together to be part of his household or his family. We're being built, verse 20, on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets and Jesus Christ himself. In other words, previous generations. Those who came before us that were used to establish and to build the church that Jesus Christ is the head of. In whom, verse 21, the whole building, that is, all of us as the household, each one of us individually, all of us collectively, are being fitted together, growing into a holy temple, a spiritual household of God. God brought us together from different cultures, different time frames, different generations, for the purpose of us becoming integrated and fitted together, to grow together. Just like your body parts grow together, and that's an analogy that Paul uses here. We're being drawn together and being fitted together, as he puts it here. Differences, of course, but the ultimate purpose we have is that we are to be drawn, all of us drawn together. And we'll see some purpose for that as we continue. Chapter 4, verse 16, similar thought. Ephesians 4, verse 16, talking about growing in truth and growing spiritually, becoming more mature. They'll just drop to the point here in verse 16, from whom the whole body, that is the church, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies. So we're not only growing together and becoming fitted together like a human body might be, but we're also serving a function and a purpose within the body or within the church. We are knit together by what we contribute, by what we have to offer, by our part in it, according to the effective working by which every part does its share and causes the growth of the body for the edifying of itself. In other words, this is a way of life that is perpetuated in God's church, that we are developing this connection with one another, serving one another, supplying the needs for each other, all doing our share. So we all work together. The New Living Translation puts it this way: under his direction, the whole body is fitted together perfectly. As each part does its own special work, it helps the other parts grow so that the whole body is healthy and growing and full of love. This is the attitude, the heart, the way that we live in our care for one another that draws us together across generational and any other lines that might otherwise separate. 1 Corinthians chapter 12. 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Verse In this chapter, Paul draws an analogy between the human body and the church of God. And in it, he emphasizes, as he touched on in the previous verse there in Ephesians, he touches on how each part of the body has a responsibility and each part of the body is valuable and important. Verse 20, 1 Corinthians 12, says, "Now indeed, there are many members, but one body." Your body has many different parts that work together so that you function. Drop down to verse 25. Chapter 12, verse 25. Leading up to this, he's saying that God built the body so that all of it works together to accomplish its purposes. Verse 25, that there should be no schism in the body, but that the members should have the same care for one another. A schism is a division. We are not to be divided as God's family. We're not divided by generation or anything else, but we all have the same care and respect for one another. He goes on to say that when one part of the body suffers, the entire body suffers. And when one part of the body rejoices, the entire body rejoices. That's, again, us functioning together as that household that we saw referenced in Ephesians 4 and in Ephesians 2, functioning together as that family, all having, again, respect for one another and what we each one has to offer to the body, and not inhibited by any schism or any division, whatever that source might be. So God intends for us to learn that lesson, to break down any barriers that would otherwise separate us, and to be the household in which, as Ephesians expresses, his Spirit can dwell. Jesus, of course, was the perfect example of one who came to serve. Matthew chapter 20, verse 25. Matthew chapter 20. This was a situation or a setting where a couple of his disciples kind of got ahead of themselves, and they were becoming a bit ambitious with their mother goading them on to try to have a special position in the kingdom that they were coming to learn about. Jesus had to set something straight, that having some major position of authority over other people was not the point. That was not what we should be seeking in our lives. Jesus said to them, verse 25 in Matthew 20, he said, "You know the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you." Jesus says very clearly that within his family, with his disciples, and later the church of which he is the head, we don't function as things do outside. We have an entirely different motivation. We don't desire to have authority and to be great among one another. But whoever desires to be great, as long as you do something that really is special, in other words, whoever to really do something that's meaningful, let him be your servant. Let him turn his heart differently to care for others rather than to seek for himself. That's one of the basic values that we have as God's people. Again, Jesus Christ being the perfect example of one who gave up, as the Word, everything to become a man, to serve, and to give his life for us. Now, being a servant is not an easy thing to do. Being a servant requires sacrifice. Being a servant requires, as we often put it, stepping outside your comfort zone. Stepping into situations where you may have to extend yourself beyond what you really think is reasonable. You know, none of us has any spare time. None of us has time on our hands. We have nothing else to do, so let's go out and help somebody. The opportunity to serve almost always comes up at a time when it is least convenient, when it is most difficult. But we have those opportunities. Jesus is saying that if you want to do something worthwhile, if you want to be someone who is going to be given great opportunities in the kingdom, then take care of each other. Serve one another. Again, this goes across all different barriers or lines or differences within the church. This is what the body does as it's growing together. All the different parts of it, all the different positions and status or who we are in the body is to be willing to care for and to serve one another. It draws us together. One more passage here in John chapter 15, a statement that Jesus made that is often quoted, and I think it's often portrayed by those in God's church, because we are a serving church, and we're learning that lesson, and we're perpetuating that lesson, and we're examples of it. I have great respect for so many who go out of their way to serve and to care for one another. Jesus said in John 15, verse 12, "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you." That's a lot to think about in that simple statement. How did he love us? I've already mentioned, he gave up everything that he was, everything that he had, to come in a human form, to sacrifice himself on our behalf because of his love for people. It's not easy to love people sometimes. It's not easy to love people who love us back sometimes. And it's certainly not easy to love people who don't show us a lot of love. But isn't that what Jesus told us that we need to be willing to do? To love those who hate us, to pray for those who persecute us. Jesus set some examples for us that are pretty amazing and difficult for us to aspire to. Can we really love one another the way he loved us? We certainly need to learn that lesson. We certainly need to be willing to reach out to one another in that way. And he says, "Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends." Doesn't seem to mean that we have to die, literally, on behalf of another person. I'm not sure, you know, generally speaking, that's not going to accomplish a whole lot. But clearly, the lesson that we learn is that we must be willing to live our lives for one another. To lay down our time and our effort and our resources for one another. That's how we express the love that God has given to us. And of course, that's a whole sermon topic in itself, to have that attitude of serving and caring for one another. But I'm applying it specifically to the fact that this is something that all generations practice and learn together. We all are in this body together. We all are growing and being knit together, and caring for one another and serving one another is part of how that happens and what it means to us. It is part of the value system, the culture that God is teaching all of us. It's kind of interesting to think about generations and the differences that there are among those, even of the same generation, and certainly between those of different generations. You find all kinds of analysis. Some of them seem pretty negative. Some of them seem pretty superficial. I think each individual is different. We can't lump everybody together under one category and call them this or that. But we all have grown up in the world that we lived in, that we faced. And each generation has its own challenges, but all of us, as God's family, have the challenge of growing together and to not let differences on this order separate us. Think about this as well. As time passes, each generation will step up and become the elders. As time passes, those who are younger eventually will become those who are older. And some who aren't even born yet will be nipping at their heels. Time passes, and those who are now younger will someday be the older and experienced leaders. What will make us, all of us, any of us, whatever generation we might be, successful as we progress through time? Well, three of these factors, I think, apply, or these three factors apply. That we take the opportunity to build on what God has given to us. Remember that Satan is opposed to God's plan at every level. And he will do what he can to disconnect the generations. So it's now our opportunity, our responsibility in every generation to build our lives on the truth of God, which never changes, to remain connected and faithful to God, and to love and to serve one another as we all grow together into the family of God.